Welcome to PMA Takes on Tech, the podcast that explores the problems, solutions, people, and ideas that are shaping the future of the produce industry. I'm your host, Bonnie Estes, Vice President of Technology for the Produce Marketing Association, and I've spent years in the ag tech sector. So I can attest, it's hard to navigate this ever-changing world in developing and adopting new solutions to industry problems. Thanks for joining us and for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. My goal of the podcast is to outline a problem in the produce industry and then discuss several possible solutions that can be deployed today. This season of PMA Takes on Tech is brought to you by Plenty. Plenty is an indoor vertical farm that sustainably grows produce using less water and land than traditional farming and no pesticides or GMOs. The farm is able to grow peak season, flavorful food year-round and deliver fresh produce to its retail partners daily. Plenty's proprietary towers and intelligent platform make it the only vertical farm that can grow multiple crops with consistently superior flavors and yield. Today's conversation is with Dana Wirth, Senior Vice President at Plenty. I originally knew Dana from Impossible Foods, where he spent nearly 6 years as VP of Sales and in Business Operations. Dana is a wealth of information on commercializing products in mission-driven companies in high growth stages. We talk about the push and pull of retailers and consumers for healthy, nutritious food. Let's jump into the conversation with Dana on his role at Plenty and some learnings from Impossible Foods.
So I run our sales, marketing, and comms teams here at Plenty. Collectively, we call that the commercial team. I have been at the company since January of 2021, so about 11 months as of now. And it's been a really fun and exciting time so far. I joined Plenty after spending almost 6 years at Impossible Foods, just down the road here in California. At Impossible Foods, I joined in 2015 as an early commercial hire. And has spent a lot of time focused on how to bring our first product there, the Impossible Burger, to market. So when I joined Impossible in 2015, we were still about a year and a half from launching at David Chang's restaurant Momofuku in New York City in July of 2016. And I helped design that launch, build the commercial team. When I first started, it was me. I did everything from answering all the customer service emails in the inbox to going on sales calls with a griddle that we'd bought at Walmart and kind of, you know, dragged down the street behind us, to, you know, thinking about securing our first social media Instagram handle, all the way up through leading the deals with Burger King and Starbucks, which are still standing today for the Impossible Whopper and the Impossible Breakfast Sandwich. My interest in the industry really started with Impossible Foods. I had very little exposure to food and ag prior to Impossible Foods. I'd been working in some healthcare work. I'd been working in emerging markets. I'd been working in fintech, most recently with PayPal. But when I met Pat Brown and the team over at Impossible, I became really interested in how important the food system is to the planet and people who live on it. And as I've learned more and more about the food system, I've really become convinced that it's pretty much the closest thing we have to a silver bullet to solve many of the problems facing the planet and the people who live here. Or put conversely, actually, one of the things that can be most negatively impactful to the planet if we don't address some of those issues. You know, the way I think about it is the food system, you know, there are 6 to 7 billion people who are consumers into the system every day, for many people multiple times a day. There's another 1 to 2 billion people who are producers into the system every single day. It obviously impacts our environment, it impacts human health, impacts the animals who live on this planet as well. And I can't think of a single system. The energy system doesn't do that. The healthcare system, the education system. I can't think of a single system that impacts so many human beings every day. And what's interesting to me about that is obviously the chance to have an impact, a positive impact on the world. So from a mission standpoint, both Impossible Foods and Plenty are mission-focused, mission-first companies. Mm-hmm. But also as a business person, I mean, what an incredible place to build a business, right? How often do you have the chance to access every human being on the planet as a potential customer? Not many businesses can claim that total addressable market, as they say. It's been really interesting watching since 2015 when I entered into the industry, just how much focus has come into the industry. Obviously, we all see the headlines about the capital that's been invested and how that's been going up, up, up over recent years. I'm of the mind that we're still massively underinvesting in the industry, given the aspects I just mentioned, given how many people are consumers, how many people are producers, and how big the challenges are. So I'm sort of a big tenter on this. I believe that it's going to take many, many companies, many, many entrepreneurs, many, many solutions to get to where we need to go, because the scale of the challenge is so great.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think, like you said, working for both those companies and having an impact, those are two really impactful areas. So indoor ag is playing an increasingly incremental role in our fresh produce supply. What are the key factors driving this? And is this a fad, as some people think, a very well-invested fad, mm-hmm. or is it here to stay?
I think there's two, as with any of these trends, there's kind of two sides to this. One is the push and the other is the pull. So I'll start with the pull, which is the consumer side. You know, consumers aren't out there saying we want indoor ag, right? They most people probably don't even know how their food is grown today, let alone think about, you know, the differences between indoor and outdoor and all the variations thereof. But consumers have been, you know, voting very strongly over the last couple decades that they do care about how their food is made, even if they don't fully understand it, right? The growth and prominence of organic is a perfect example of consumers caring, right? And consumers voting their dollars on how they care. My belief is they care about things, obviously taste, right? We all know that taste is number one. That being said, everything in the grocery store is designed to be tasty for the most part. Doritos are tasty. Ice cream is tasty. There's lots of things that are tasty. So saying that, I think of taste as a necessary but not sufficient condition. You know, if you're not tasty, that's going to be a problem. But just because you're tasty doesn't mean that you are that you're going to succeed. The second, you know, really big one, I think, especially in the produce space, is cleanliness. And I think there's kind of a lurking unknown in consumers' minds about cleanliness. So what does that mean? Like, why are some things no need to wash, but some are triple washed, and some I have to wash at home, and some, like, what is, there's kind of a, I think, like I said, a lurking belief of, like, I'm not quite sure what exactly is on my produce.
And do you think that's tied to food safety, like staying safe with the food that you eat, or is it more dirt, or is it more insecticides, or is it all those things?
Yeah, I think it probably doesn't, for most consumers, doesn't break down into any particular components. It's more of a, this, you know, dirty is bad, right? I'm not quite sure how it's bad. It could be as bad as, oh my gosh, I could end up sick. And I see these, you know, certainly people are aware of recalls, but it could be as minor as, you know, this looks dirty, right? Even if it's completely, completely harmless. The other thing is, you know, the way I think about it is produce in some ways, is not a great consumer experience, right? If you were to just step back and think about produce as a product, where else in the grocery store do you have things that when you get them home, you could have, you know, a third or half the pack not be what it was represented to be, right? It could be rotten. It could be moldy. It could be something you didn't think you were buying. Uh-huh. You also, depending on what time of year you buy it, what time of week you buy it, depending on the store you buy it at, you can get a completely different product, right? A strawberry is not a strawberry. A strawberry can be many different things depending on when and where you buy it. And a product that you often end up throwing a large amount away because it goes bad in your fridge. If you think about that in the context of the grocery store, like if Cheerios had that value proposition, it would be a terrible product, right? Like, hey, by the way, Cheerios are different depending on where you get them and what time of year you get them. Oftentimes they go bad and you don't know exactly what they're going to taste like before you open the packet. People wouldn't buy that product. And I actually think it's a testimony to how important produce is in people's lives that people continue to buy produce, even despite all the downsides that come along with that product. And so that's the framework I use for thinking about what can any production system, whether it's indoor ag or otherwise, what are the solutions we can bring to the consumer? It's about making it a more reliable product. It's about making it a cleaner, you know, put cleaner in quotes, but a cleaner product in consumers' minds, about making it a more nutritious product, making it something that I can get what I'm expecting to get.
So how do you think what Plenty is doing and your technology can solve that issue, especially around strawberries, since I know you're working on strawberries?
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the obvious solutions here is by being able to provide a consistent environment and being able to control all the knobs, like we can at Plenty, we can produce a great strawberry, we believe, in conjunction with our partners at Driscoll's, year round. And it's always a great day, as we like to say, it's always a great day in Watsonville inside a Plenty farm. So as some of your listeners may know, we have a publicly announced partnership with Driscoll's, where we're working with their world-class genetics, as well as our world-class indoor environment, with the goal of producing really game-changing strawberries. So that's an area, not the only area, but certainly an area where indoor ag, to your original question, I think can really deliver some big gains.
And are you publicly making any prediction of when I may have Plenty strawberries in my refrigerator?
I am not publicly making any predictions about Plenty strawberries, but we will get you some at some point, Bonnie.
Good. I'm looking forward to that. So how can companies like Plenty increase awareness about CEA among retailers of how it is different from organic or non-GMO or many of the other different types of categories?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and actually comes back to the push side. So we were talking about the pull from the consumer, the push from the retailer. You know, in the long run, the retailer's interests align with the consumer's interests. But in the short and medium run, that's not always the case. And especially right now with all the supply chain challenges that retailers have had, labor challenges retailers have had, and general COVID challenges retailers have had over the last year and a half, they've got their hands full for sure. And so they are oftentimes solving for related but somewhat different things. So you know, we hear from a lot of retailers that reducing recalls would be a huge benefit to them. Just that is one of the biggest things that disrupts their produce department on a what seemingly consistent basis. That is, it's a huge pain point for them. We also hear, you know, consistency, just being able to know when I'm going to have product, know when I'm going to be able to stock my shelves, right? They're trying to run a business. They've got a lot of different pieces to manage, and having something that's so volatile makes it really challenging to run that business. I've also heard from most produce managers that that's why they love produce, by the way, that they went into that business because they love the dynamic nature of it. But that is it's a constant struggle that they're trying to manage. The other thing we're hearing from retailers is that they want to ensure their supply going forward. So everyone is thinking about, how do I make sure that whether it's supply chain difficulties, whether it's climate related pressures on the field, they want to make sure that obviously they're going to be able to keep their shelves stocked. As they think towards the future, you know, they're looking at controlled environment or indoor agriculture as a way to make sure that they have consistent access to the products that they know their consumers want. So that's what we're hearing from retailers. What's interesting is there's, I think, a shared understanding between retailers and other indoor folks that we do need to figure out how to talk to the consumer about this. Mm-hmm. And I'll use an analogy from my Impossible days. You know, until Impossible and Beyond really started coming out with some of the more innovative products that we debuted in the mid 2010s, so in kind of 2015, 2016, 2017, everything was a veggie burger, right? Like if you ever had a Dr. Prager's or a Morningstar burger, it was veggie burger. That was the term. That's what I grew up with. Around the time that Impossible and Beyond started releasing their products, plant-based became a term that became better known by consumers, to the point now when you walk into many retail grocers, you'll see plant-based as a section heading. And the interesting thing about plant-based is, you know, plant-based has a lot of positive connotations. So if you were to walk out and grab a consumer out of a grocery store and say, what is plant-based? They'll say, oh, it's probably better for you, better for the environment. Something that I try to do, you know, I'm doing my part to try to make, you know, my life or the planet's life healthier. And that became kind of a code word, a short code for consumers in a complex grocery store, in a way to make decisions. And we haven't had that moment yet for indoor or CEA. Neither of those terms mean anything to a consumer. CEA in particular is a pretty terrible consumer term.
It is, yeah.
and so, you know, one of the things that I think both retailers and, you know, and I certainly recognize, I would imagine other indoor producers recognize, is the need to have what I think of as our plant-based moment. Like, what is the term that we can that we can put out into the world that neatly summarizes the value and the benefits to the consumer, as opposed to a description of the production method, which is not particularly useful. You know, CEA or indoor is not particularly useful to the consumer. And, you know, organic's an interesting case study where it was a description of a production method that has come to mean something to the consumer, not because they're necessarily thinking there's a particular process, right? But they does have this, it is a term that has this kind of set of benefits behind it that consumer, you know, I'm sure every consumer thinks about it a little differently. We know many consumers don't think about it correctly, but right. That's not necessarily important. They think of it as this set of benefits that they can count on when they are in the store. And we haven't had that moment yet for what we do. And it's going to be a big part of my focus going forward. And I would invite others in the industry to join me as well. I think it benefits everyone. You know, going back to what I said in the beginning, the challenges we face around the food and ag system are too big to be tackled by any one company alone.
So what would that mean to a consumer? Like, if you could communicate, we're growing this indoors or we're growing this vertically, and the consumer would go, oh, that means these benefits. So what kind of benefits are you trying to communicate to them that they would think, I want to buy this because of all the, you know, this bucket of benefits?
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying about the ways in which produce is kind of a broken product. So it would be, you're going to get what it says on the label, meaning if it says delicious strawberries, they're delicious strawberries. You're going to get something that is clean, right? So if it's no need to wash, it truly is no need to wash, and I can count on it being clean. And I think being clean, you know, we hold ourselves to a standard. For example, we say no pesticides on our product, because we believe actually a lot of what consumers want when they're thinking about clean is no pesticides, and correctly, you know, of course, right? Like, pesticides are the thing that most consumers should be worried about. So that's a big part of it. And then I think the consistency as well. So knowing that, and it's related to, you know, getting what it says on the label, but it's a slightly different thing. Knowing that I can buy this product 52 weeks a year, and I'm going to get something that I or my kids will enjoy.
I think for me, your market research of one here is that it's just how long it lasts in the shelf life, and that I know that, you know, whatever it says on the label, it's going to last at least till that date and probably longer, and it's going to last longer than a couple of days after I buy it, no matter what. So I think for me, that's a huge benefit. And I think that's one thing that, people who grow other ways are going to need to step up a little bit to meet that demand of consumers that, you know, we just have longer shelf life, especially in supply chains, the way that they are.
Yeah, and it's a great point. And obviously, with indoor, there's a few ways we can address that. You know, putting production closer to consumption is the obvious one. But even more minor things, like because of how we harvest, we're able to go from harvest into a cold tunnel, you know, into refrigeration within seconds, not days, not hours, not days. But not hours, right? And in doing so, we're able to kind of freeze the product in time and get it out to consumers faster. So there's a few, you know, there's the obvious one of location and food miles, but there's also some other things that you can do when you have such tight control over your system. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how does this work, you think, as far as where it fits, both in how it works in cannibalizing outdoor growing? And then I've heard people talk about it. I heard one retailer say, well, I only have room on my shelf for, you know, these leafy greens in a package for a certain amount. And so I'm going to put indoor grown in there, and I'm going to get rid of organic. I'm not going to carry organic anymore. So just when you think about, I think my view right now is the pie is continuing to kind of get bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got great products and the pie is going to get bigger, but that can't go on forever. So at some point, the retailer and the consumer is going to have to make a decision of like, what do I buy? And then how does that affect organic and then outdoor growing? How do you kind of see it shaking out going forward?
Yeah, I think if you zoom out and think about the retailer's store, obviously shelf space is the premium, but it's a little more complicated in produce because refrigerated shelf space is actually the premium, you know, the premium that we're all trading. if you listen to every public retailer's earnings calls, strategy days, et cetera, fresh, right? Fresh is their number one priority. Fresh is what continues to bring consumers into the store. I've joked a few times that, you know, fresh is to retail, brick and mortar retail, what ESPN is to cable. Right? it's the reason why you keep your cable subscription. It's the reason why people keep going into stores. You know, I believe in a future where we're going to, you know, if you're not already, most people will be buying their toilet paper and their paper towels online. And that they're going to continue to go into the store for things, you know, for meat, fish, and produce. And retailers have all know this, obviously. That's why they talk about it with their investors. That's why they're making massive investments in the fresh space. And so, and to put a finer point about growing the pie, sure, but literally actually physically talking about growing the sections in the store, right? Growing the sections, growing the perimeter, growing the refrigerated space in the stores, right? Doing all that to make sure they've got room to bring more fresh in. I think that's a very real thing, and it aligns very well with retailer strategies right now. There's also within the refrigerated fresh cases, it's not just produce that's in there, right? So there's trade-offs with other products. So you even within the given set space you have today, you can expand produce relative to the other fresh refrigerated items. And then there's, of course, as you mentioned, trade-offs within the fresh, you know, within a given set of fresh produce. I think that there's, you know, what's interesting about that is at least the way we think about it at Plenty is, you know, we can help partner with existing field growers. You know, we were down, you and I were both down at Western Growers Association a couple of weeks ago. And you know, we were there looking to, you know, to make friends, not enemies. Like we believe that we can partner with existing growers to help them grow in this way, because we believe that this is the way forward. And so while you might see, you know, when it gets down to the fine point, might see cannibalization again after the third layer down here, but you might see cannibalization between outdoor and indoor grown products. Behind that, you might see, and we believe you will see, outdoor growers investing in indoor grown techniques. And so is that, it may not be cannibalization from the producer side. It may be just a trade up for consumers to a product that we believe brings more, you know, more benefit to the consumer than what they're getting today.
Yeah, I think it may end up being just kind of a portfolio of different ways to grow. So I consider myself a producer. I produce these kinds of products, leafy greens or others, and I do it outside here. I do it inside here. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of risk mitigation, especially with climate change, I think. And here in California, as we worry more and more about water availability, I think it's smart for the outdoor growers to say, do I need to have a risk-adjusted portfolio of the way that I grow things?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, to the extent that the folks who are listening to this podcast are outdoor growers, those are conversations that we're already having and are, you know, eager to have more of. So I'd love to include anyone who's interested in learning more.
Great. So one of the things that you've done in your role, which I think was a bit of a new role when you came, was building relationships with retailers and really looking at as Plenty grows and you grow open the farm in Compton and you start some other farms, just really having those different retailers that are in different parts of the country and kind of how do you work with them. So what's that been like for you? And when you walk in to talk to retailers new, you know, do you have to explain everything or do they kind of know what's going on?
Yeah, it's been really great. I mean, it's probably my favorite part of the job is spending time with our customers. In this case, it's retailers. You know, at Impossible, I focus mostly on food service operators. Here at Plenty, I've been working mostly with retailers. I was lucky to be introduced as I came in to our partners at Safeway Albertsons. So Plenty has a publicly announced deal we did back in 2020 rather, with Safeway Albertsons to be partners in our California expansion once the Compton farm is up and running. And so those were some relationships that were already built. But we've continued to have really productive conversations, both with retailers here in California, as well as across the country. And like I said, I enjoy it because I think that, you know, there are visionaries within all of these retailers who are thinking about the future and thinking about how to move their business to the next level. And connecting with those people is really gratifying. because you know, it's like you find that person who sees the world in the same way that you do. And when you have a partner like that, you can actually create a ton of value. And so I'll give an example, like when you connect with the person who also says, yes, we need to figure out what the plant-based quote unquote moment is for this industry. How do we communicate this to the retailer or to the consumer? Well, now you have all the tools in place, right? You have the retailer who has control over their shelves. You have us as the producer who has control over how we grow. And together, if we have we have a shared mission to communicate to the consumer, well, wow, now we can do a whole lot. So I've enjoyed building those relationships. I view, you know, as you can probably tell, I view them as partnerships where we're like, we've learned a lot as Plenty in the last 8 years building this company. We have obviously points of view on the future and where the industry is going, and the opportunity to share those points of views with retailers is fantastic. One of the most fun things to do is actually to bring folks up to our research facility in Laramie, Wyoming. Mm-hmm. So we have
Summer, right?
I'll go whenever they want to go. I'm an East Coaster originally, and I miss winter sometimes. So,
well, you can get that in Laramie.
Yeah, it was 13 degrees last time I was there last week. So I enjoy, you know, we have about, just over 60 people there, full time R&D, plant science, about just over a dozen PhDs, and you know, the first time I went, I joked it was kind of like Santa's workshop. We've got a bunch of different production environments where we're testing. And it's really where a lot of it's the core of our plant science work that happens there. Obviously located there because Nate Story, our co-founder, did all of his graduate work at University of Wyoming. We still have a really good, strong set of folks coming out of the university there. And I think when we bring retailers there, it often helps connect the dots for how what we're doing is really technology and innovation based. And we've made this massive investment in technology that will benefit them, right? Like we've made that investment, and the retailers get to reap the rewards of it. And getting to tell that story is really exciting.
Yeah, I bet that's really cool to take people who work in produce and see the product all day to a place. I haven't been to Laramie. I've seen a lot of your research in South San Francisco, but that must be really enlightening to them, you know, because it looks so different than Salinas, which is great in its own way, but this is something they haven't seen before. So that must be very fun.
Yeah. It's getting kind of wide. I still get wide eyed at, you know, then thinking about all the different knobs you can turn, all the different dials you can turn when you have that degree of control. You know, how much more light can you put into the system? What are cultivars that we can grow, for example, that may have been discarded because they weren't fit for purpose outdoors? So there's all sorts of fun things you can do when you have these kinds of environments.
You had mentioned food service when you're talking about Impossible. Are you working in food service at all with Plenty? Are you trying to supply that part of that segment?
We are currently in retail. So the way that I think about things today is we are currently in about 50 retailers here in Northern California. That is supplied entirely out of our South San Francisco farm, which is sold out and has been for some time. That is kind of partially an R&D farm and partially a commercial farm. Really our big expansion is coming when we open the Compton facility next year down in Southern California. That'll be our big debut from a, you know, from a brand and commercial standpoint. And I do think there's a case for the product in food service. As you mentioned, I spent quite a bit of time in food service in my days at Impossible. And I think there's a case for the same reason there's a case in retail. Consumers, you know, care about how their product is made. They care about quality, and those things are all very much, very much things that you can communicate in a food service environment. And I think food service operators, at least certain food service operators, would be very interested.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. So there's been a big shift in consumer behavior over the last 12 months or so. What are consumers craving in a post-pandemic world, and how can retailers ensure they're delivering the demand for fresher produce to consumers?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's obviously a bit of a roller coaster, and not just the initial COVID-induced pieces, but the subsequent supply chain challenges. One of the things, my view is that some of these habits will stick. But people are creatures of habit, meaning a lot of what people move to will eventually revert. The things that I think will stick are, I do believe that the cooking at home lessons that people were forced to teach themselves will have enduring ramifications. So whether that means more meals at home or just higher quality ingredients in meals at home, I think that we'll see that in treating that meal more like a, not treating it like a restaurant experience, but treating it more like a, or being able to have a premium experience at home, I guess is how I would think about it. And that'll obviously have positive ramifications for cart size and ring in store. So I think that's one, like I said before, I do think that for staples, people, will very much continue to move white goods, onto your recurring purchases on Amazon or elsewhere, and not need to go to the store. But I think that the folks who did move over for fresh, certainly some of them will stay doing, online grocery for fresh, but that, there's going to be a certain amount of returning to the store. I mean, we already saw it, a certain amount of returning to the store, when it's safe to do so. Just because people value that fresh experience. And by the way, the brick and mortar retailers, know this, right? And so they're innovating, as I mentioned before, they're innovating on this fresh experience to make it an attractive place, to come.
Yeah. I've seen some, when I was at CES, I think it was a couple of years ago, and they were showing like the grocery store of the future where everything that now is in the center of the store is upstairs. Mm-hmm. And so they have it upstairs and it's all managed by robots where, you go in and you place the order for all those things, and then you pick all your produce, and then you go to the checkout and your toilet paper and your razor blades and paper towels are already packed. And so just have the store, be this beautiful place of, flowers and produce and the rest of stuff's upstairs.
And discovery, right? The other, when I think about the value that that brick and mortar retailer has, it's twofold. It's discovery. So it's very hard to discover new things online. Meaning like it's just, you don't have the same ability to browse, right? Of course you can if you're really dogged and diligent, but it doesn't have quite the same experience of, oh, there's a cheese that I had never bought before, but it looks interesting, right? That's an experience that I have when I'm in the grocery store. And then it's immediacy, right? It's okay, I need this thing today, I need it now. The second one though is being, could potentially be eroded by some of the, both the fast grocery delivery and the ultra fast grocery delivery that is just now expanding in the US. Retailers, I think know this, and they, are really focusing on that fresh experience in store.
Yeah. Well, my last question, and you've talked about this a little bit, but you and I first met when you were at Impossible Foods, and I was doing some work there as well. And so it's interesting. I mean, it's kind of a Silicon Valley, wonder story that you've worked for these two really amazing companies that have fast growth curves and are kind of market definers. So can you talk a little bit more about what some of the parallels are and what are some of the differences and some of the things that you've learned in working for two companies like this?
Yeah, I've been really lucky to work with some incredible people and on some incredible ideas. For me, it comes back to the mission. The reason why I'm interested in this space in the first place is it's the place where I think you have the biggest ability to make the biggest change for the most amount of people on the planet. And, why not focus on the system that touches the most people every single day and has the biggest delta in my belief between where we are now and where we need to be or where we could be. Within that space, that creates lots of opportunities for mission-based companies. And you see them not just Impossible and Plenty, but many others. I advise a company called Clara that does egg fermentation based egg replacements. And there's 100, if not 1,000 others now. And I think that's super exciting. The key though for me is these companies exist for the mission, right? Like we used to say at Impossible, if we could achieve the mission, we would shut down the company tomorrow. The company doesn't exist for its own self-perpetuation. It exists to serve a mission. And the same thing is true for Plenty. We exist to serve a mission. We see, we have a view of what the future world should look like, and we are all in on getting there. And then we can be done, right? And the reality is, of course, the mission is so big that it's going to be a long time before we're done.
Won't be our lifetime, probably.
But when you work for a company like that, it really helps clarify decisions. It helps clarify, why we choose A over B, why we invest in a certain way, who we hire, how we make decisions at the management team level. And so that's what I'd say is shared between Impossible and Plenty is working for a mission-based company And then obviously in a sector that, as I mentioned, I think has an incredible ability to impact our future. It's also, as I mentioned before, it's really exciting to work with partners, whether it's partners like Driscoll's or retailer partners like Safeway Albertsons, who share that vision for the future, and finding those people who say, yeah, I do believe that there's a different way that the future is going to look from today. And it's both it's the struggle and the fun, right? An impossible. I on more than one occasion was cursed at in people's kitchens. So I went, you know, when I was in there, especially in the early days, you know, they thought I was some crazy hippie from California with a veggie burger trying to ruin their kitchen. And, you know, I was told to, in not nice terms, to get out and go the other way. But in some ways, it's interesting, right? When people feel that passionately about something, like, you know, you're onto an important issue. And I have not been cursed at yet at Plenty, thankfully. But there,
leafy greens may not be quite so controversial.
Hey, but berries, people feel strongly about their berries.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's an opportunity, you know, the flip side of that is the opportunity, when, as I said, to partner with folks who share that vision all across the industry, and, you know, the ability to see that come into fruition. And so I'm almost 7 years out, at Impossible, and it still makes me smile every time I walk into a Starbucks and I see the Impossible breakfast sandwich right there on the menu, right? That's something that that we, you know, we brought into the world. And I, you know, believe the same is true for Plenty. Like, we're going to be sitting here 6-7 years from now. Maybe we can do another podcast interview then. looking at the farms we've built and the products that are on shelf, and, you know, knowing that we, with our partners, brought that into the world.
Is there anything culturally, in addition to the mission of both companies and being very mission-driven, anything about the culture of these companies or the management or any parallels or differences there?
Yeah, I think there's something that's really invigorating about this particular stage in the company. So we're at the stage of Plenty, right? We've been investing for the better part of a decade in our technology and our system, and we're now building this farm in Compton that'll be the largest indoor farm by output when it opens next year. And we're just on the verge of taking all the hard work that the engineers and the scientists have done and turning it into something, turning it into a product, turning it into a commercial enterprise. And that particular transition point, I went through that transition at Impossible. Same thing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on upfront technology before a single product was ever in the market. That turning point is a real kind of in the foxhole together type turning point, where you are you've got a small group of people. Usually the companies are quite, you know, still relatively small at this stage, as Plenty is, who are working really closely together to make this happen. So I've certainly experienced that Impossible. We have that here at Plenty, where we've got, you know, a really good group of people who are here because they really believe in what we're doing, and because of that, it's a great culture. I love this piece of it. And actually, I think one of the biggest risks to companies as they get more successful is they attract people who chase success, as opposed to attract people who are interested in the process, interested in the way you get there. Everyone can identify the successes after the fact. It's more, I admire more and want to work more with people who love the process of getting there.
That's it for this episode of PMA Takes on Tech. Thanks for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. Be sure to check out all our episodes at pma.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, and I would love to get any comments or suggestions of what you might want me to take on. For now, stay safe, eat your fruits and vegetables, and we will see you next time.